night. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate.
Yeah.
You know, that classic, that Let There Be Drums. I think sometime I'm going to just like go home and I'm going to sit there and I'm going to say, we got to do this. We got to actually, I'm going to just turn it up as loud as I can and just blast it out my windows and see what my neighbors think. Because those drums just drive me crazy, all right? And they're a call. They're a call to all the things that we need to face up to, that we need to do today and in the world. We have a very powerful show for you today. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Stephanie Myers, who is one of the editors of the book Atheist Guide to Christmas, and Paul Krassner, the satirist and writer Paul Krassner, who is one of the contributors to the book. Before that, we'll be hearing from Bob Avakian talking about the conspiracy to get the police off each and every time they kill someone. But opening the show up, I'm really, really happy to be bringing back to the show Carl Dix, a representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party, a co-founder of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and one of the initiators of Rise Up October, the powerful three-day action that brought people from all over the country, including 100 families of people murdered by the police, to New York City to demand an end to police murder of black and brown people. Carl is joining us to talk about the recent mistrial that was declared in Baltimore in the trial of one of the cops that killed Freddie Gray last spring. And we're also going to be talking about what the hell is going on in Chicago. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on again, Michael.
Sure. Let's jump into this, man, because I want to squeeze everything we can out of this, all right? And I want to go as just you just run with it, man. All right? What do you make? Okay. What do you make of this, man? They've been telling us all along, well, the cops are being put on trial, all the officials, everybody's like, yeah, well, look, Baltimore's this, a different Baltimore. This is, you know, we're putting these guys on trial. They're facing up. They're going to have to pay for what they did. They talked about this all the way through, and then all of a sudden, the first trial, they declare a mistrial. All right? What do you make of this, man?
Well, what I make of this is that the authorities in Baltimore felt forced to put some of their cops on trial. But putting a cop on trial is not the same as justice, and it's not the same as anybody paying for the murderous deeds that these killer cops carry out, especially in black and Latino communities. Because you look at this trial, this cop admitted that he talked to Freddie Gray and that Freddie told him he was hurt and needed medical attention and wanted to go to the hospital. He didn't get Freddie any medical attention or take him to the hospital. He saw that he was shackled and being bounced around on the floor of the police van. He put Freddie back up on the seat, but would not strap the seat belt to keep him from being bounced around. He admits this, and then he said, well, nobody on the police force pays much attention to the policy of strapping the prisoners in the van in. So it's basically like, yeah, I did it, but the people that I hang with always do that. So why are you blaming me? But that was a good enough defense because I don't have a lot of, I think that the way the prosecution carried out the case had a lot of problems, but some of the charges came down to very basic things. Did you provide him medical care when he asked for it? Did you buckle him into the seat? There were charges related to those inactions, and the jury couldn't even convict him on that. This comes down to police doing what they're supposed to do and then the system backing them up when they do it. That's what you have to say about this trial.
It's really important, too, because it's kind of a pivotal outcome here when, you know, people are looking at it, well, it's a mistrial and, you know, the judge will decide or they'll decide, they'll talk about it and they'll figure out what they're going to do. Are they going to proceed? Are they going to bring him back to trial? Are they going to make him come later? But actually, there's a lot of places where people were reviewing this thing of that this was kind of a pivotal. This was a pivotal trial. The trial against this one cop was actually pivotal because they were building the prosecution of the other five cops directly tied into this trial. And they were even meant to build on the conviction of Porter in order to have him then turn around and testify against the other cops. This was not sort of like, okay, well, we didn't make it on this one, but we'll get with these other five. This was a heavy, heavy scene in terms of what standards they've set and what they're actually trying to do.
Yeah, see, that's true. And one of the questions I have about the prosecution approach was that thing of building off of the trial of Porter, because one thing that the defense was able to use in this was that well, look, I wasn't the one most to blame. There were other cops, like his supervisor was there, the driver, who's the one who actually administered the rough ride. They are the ones who are really responsible, was part of his defense. And they didn't even bring in and make much of a deal out of Porter's arrest, Gray's arrest. The fact that he was arrested for nothing more than seeing the cops and running, and then for a small knife that they found on him, that was their reason for arresting him, trussing him up like, shackling him the way that the slaves used to be shackled as they were being transported from one part of the plantation to another, and then giving him a rough ride. So that approach of we're going to build on the one who has lesser culpability to get to the ones who have more actually gave him an opening to blame somebody else. So that's a part of it. But then there was discussion that happened afterward that makes clear this thing about the role of the police, in my opinion. And that is, they were discussing this question of police getting the benefit of the doubt. And all of the talking heads on the media were saying, well, of course, police deserve the benefit of the doubt when they get charged in cases like this. And then you have to say, why do they deserve the benefit of the doubt? What is it that gives them that kind of opening? Because this benefit of the doubt thing has been used to justify and cover up murder after murder committed by the police, horrific acts of brutality. But then you give them the benefit of the doubt and give them a pass on it. And it really comes down to a license to kill, and to kill in ways that give you what the role of the police is. Because, look, Bob Avakian, the leader of the Revolutionary Communist Party, says the role of the police is not to serve and protect the people. It is to serve and protect the system that rules over the people, to enforce the relations of exploitation and oppression, the conditions of poverty, misery, and degradation into which this system has cast people and is determined to keep people in. The law and order that the police are about, with all of their brutality and murder, is a law and order that enforces all this oppression and madness. And that's a quote from Avakian out of his book of quotations and short essays titled Basics. And that's why this system gives the police the benefit of the doubt, because they need to have those frontline enforcers who are in position to protect the system and its relations of savage oppression and vicious exploitation against the people, hold people down so that the system can continue to rob them. That's what we're dealing with here. And that's why getting a cop indicted, rare though it is, because, you know, of the more than 1,100 people killed by police, several hundred of them unarmed and doing nothing wrong, there have only been 6 cases where cops, and I'm talking about this year alone, just in 2015, there are only 6 cases where cops who killed anybody have gotten indicted. That's why I say rare though it is. But a cop being indicted doesn't mean a cop is going to get punished for murderous deeds, because we've seen again and again where those indictments come down, but then the prosecutors forget how to prosecute. The court finds some obscure reason to throw the case out, and the killer cops continue to walk. So that's why it's very important that people pose, indict, convict, and send the killer cops to jail. You know, and I know there are people who are believers in the system who say, well, it's wrong to put convict and sending to jail together with indictment, because doesn't the cop deserve a fair trial? Killer cops get far more than a fair trial. They usually get no trial, no matter how horrific their murderous deeds are. But even when they get indicted, the system bends over backwards to get them off.
Mm-hmm. You know, Carl, we're going to get into that a little bit in just a few minutes when we move on to Chicago. But I really wanted to pursue a couple things here, because as I was looking into and reading and thinking about what happened in Baltimore this past week, I kept thinking of the word bamboozle, because there's all of these things that come up, and it's very heavy, and you referred to one of them, where this statement that the mayor came out and, like, in all, you know, like, oh, there's calm. Meanwhile, she's got, like, thousands of cops on the streets. They, you know, they're all prepared. They're all beefed up, militarized, and all this stuff, and they're looking to prevent any breakouts and all this stuff. But she had the audacity to make that statement that you referred to earlier. She said, justice is not a verdict. Justice is a process that we have to protect. Now, think about that. Think about that, man. What the, you know, let's talk about that a little bit, because it seems to concentrate some of what you were just talking about. Justice isn't a verdict. It doesn't matter what happens to you. As long as you went through the process, went through the show, let's talk bamboozled.
Yeah, exactly. You're supposed to see, well, they at least brought the cop to court and made him go through a trial. And then you're supposed to hope against hope that this time the cop will get convicted. Because after all, Freddie Gray was fine when he saw those cops in the neighborhood and ran away from them. And unfortunately, he didn't run fast enough or far enough and got caught. But he was fine before these cops came upon him. Then he comes upon the cops, and his spine is nearly severed. He's unconscious, and in a week, he's dead. So obviously, it's right out in front that these cops, through their actions and their inactions, are the ones who are responsible for his death. So you hope that the system is going to do something. And the point is, they need to keep us hoping, believing and hoping, believing that the system can be made to work in our interest. Like, maybe it usually doesn't. But in a case like this, where so many people are watching, where there was obviously so much public anger over what happened, maybe this time is going to be the time that justice comes down. So that as long as you're thinking this system can work for you, then you're sucked in.
Mm-hmm.
They got you hooked. They got you caught. And they go at this again and again and again. And then, like you said, they had all the cops in the world backing up the bamboozlement that was being done. Because they not only had all of the Baltimore City police out there, they got the Maryland State Police. They brought police from other jurisdictions outside of Baltimore into the city to make sure that they had the intimidating force to get those who didn't get sucked in by getting them to look at the process and not look at the question of another black man is dead and no police have been punished in any way. Well, if you're not taken in by that whole process thing, then look at the force that we have out here to keep you in place.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party, Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and Rise Up October. And we're talking about the first trial of the first cop that has been put on trial for killing Freddie Gray. And actually, he wasn't even charged with murder. He was charged with, what was it, manslaughter? Was that it?
He was charged with manslaughter and several charges related to dereliction of duty.
Right. And we're also going to be talking about what the hell is going on in Chicago. Now, Carl, one of the things I wanted to jump into, I want people to know, to think about this, because when we're talking about people being bamboozled, and this is actually not just, it's tactical and strategic on the part of the system, and there's a way that this is actually happening in a certain sense here, and it's related to what is going on in Chicago. In the New York Times article about the mistrial declared, the declaration of a mistrial in Porter, and that cop Porter and his murder of Freddie Gray in Baltimore, they made this point about you can't be knee-jerk in reacting to the declaration of a mistrial. After all, there are complex racial dynamics in play here. You have black authorities, black cops. Some of the defendants are even black. You know, the mayor's black, all this other stuff. And similar in Chicago, they talk about Rahm Emanuel. Hey, come on, he's part of the Obama saviorship. This is kind of, he's down with the black people. And so you can't be talking about that this is actually a racialized thing. Let's talk about this, because in Baltimore, they made a big deal out of all this. It's not, you can't bring race into it. The people are just ignorant. They need to understand. We need to help them understand it has nothing to do with the color of their skin.
Well, I mean, that's more the bamboozlement. And it's a conscious part of the bamboozlement. The reason that there are black elected officials, black police chiefs, black authority figures in other positions in the system is actually to try to cover up the racial dynamics of the way in which the criminal injustice system operates. That's a very particular part of it, because it was really in the wake of the rebellions of the 1960s that you began to see this proliferation of black faces in high places. And a lot of what the rebellions were about was about the way that people were being abused and mistreated by the police. So you start putting black faces on this, and that can obscure it for people and make them think, oh, okay, well, it was about race, but it's not anymore because we got a black guy at City Hall. And it reached the height of, in 2008, there was a black president. But there was something very important that, again, Bob Avakian, the leader of the Revolutionary Communist Party, spoke to about that. He said that was the system playing its trump card, working to get people, especially black people, but other people who had become disaffected at the system, and especially in the deep, difficult situation that the system had gotten itself into, both domestically with the continued attacks on black people with the economic meltdown of 2007, but also around the world with the way in which the U.S. was widely being hated for the wars it was carrying out in the Middle East and other abusive and imperialistic moves it was making around the world. Well, we could put this black guy in there, and that could serve to shore up the U.S.'s reputation internationally and among people in this country, bring disaffected people back into the fold. But the thing that was pretty clear that people needed to understand, not just that it's happening, but understand why it's happening, is that you got this black president, this person that people felt, well, he will make this system operate differently towards black people. People also thought that he was going to stop the wars and change other things about the way the system operated. But that was just a black face on the same old system. It continued to operate in the same way. And people are seeing that, but not understanding why. And people, as long as they don't see the class interest involved in all of this, they are going to continue to be taken in, tricked, fooled, and yes, bamboozled by the system as it continues to operate to keep this system and its oppression and exploitation of people, the majority of people in this country, and the overwhelming majority of people around the world in effect. And that's what we're dealing with, and that's what people have to come to understand.
Mm-hmm. Now let's turn to Chicago, Carl. This is very heavy. I mean, there is a major crisis erupting there, and if people haven't been paying attention, they need to be. You know, it's not just Laquan McDonald was actually just the thing that really burst the bubble in a lot of ways, but this has been coming up time and time again. I don't know how many family members I've spoken to on this show about their loved ones being murdered by the Chicago police and all these things that you read about. There is a major crisis erupting, and it's hitting hard at some of the very basic ways that this society, that this system rules over people, calling all kinds of things into question, as you were pointing out earlier. What do you make of this, Carl? What do you make of this whole situation there?
Well, this is a very important situation because, like you say, the Laquan McDonald murder and the video of it finally being released 1 year after the murder is what broke things out into the open. Because here you have a young man who the police gunned down in October of last year. It's caught on video. It's actually caught on several videos. The authorities knew about these videos, and the videos show real clear that the guy was murdered. Then the police put together reporting that says, well, he lunged at us and we had no choice but to gun him down. And this wasn't just said by the cop who fired the shots that killed him. This was said by all of the cops. And then a representative of the police goes on TV and gives this story. But it's all false. It's all concocted. And they have a video that shows that. But they keep the video covered up. They keep the video covered up, and it's known all the way up to the mayor's office that this video exists. They give the family a settlement of, I think, $5 million, hoping that they can buy them off and shut them up. But the battle to get this video out goes on, and then the video gets released, and all of a sudden, the day that the video is released, the cop gets indicted for murder, a murder that it's clear that he committed by looking at the video, which they've had for more than a year. And the reason I said several videos is because there were commercial establishments that had video that caught this as well. The police came to those establishments and said, we need your video because there was a police incident that we need to look at on it. They take the video from these establishments, and then they return it with 86 minutes missing. And those 86 minutes cover the time frame when Laquan McDonald was murdered. So these cops erased that section of the video so that that would not be a way that it got out. But since the McDonald video has gotten out, a young man named Johnson, his family, Robert Johnson, I believe, is his first name, his family, who had been fighting to get a video of his killing by police out, also for more than a year, it's gotten released. And it shows the police shooting him in the back as he runs from them. Those cops were never charged. And they say, well, it looks like he has a gun in his hand, which I've seen the video numerous times. There's no way you can say that. He seems to have his hand out as he runs, and they just shoot him in the back. But they exonerate that. See, and this kind of stuff had been going on forever, not just the killings, but the brutality, the frame-ups. They had several different places where the police were running torture chambers. One of them was run by this cop, John Berg, who would take people and torture them until they confessed to various crimes, including crimes that landed people on death row. And a number of people have gotten their convictions overturned after that got exposed. Then, a couple years later, they learned that the Chicago cops were still running a torture chamber at a place called Holman Square. That's being dragged out into the open. All of this is going on, and then people are taking to the streets and demanding that all of the officials who had any role in this need to be thrown out of office, indicted, and going on trial and convicted for their role in the cover-up of this police terror. And then you've got the officials trying to figure out how we're going to hold the line. You've got the mayor firing some of his underlings and saying he's going to put together a task force to study the problem. You got the Department of Justice saying it's going to come in and investigate it, which at first the mayor was opposed to, but now he's saying, oh, of course I welcome a Department of Justice investigation. But all of this is aimed not at doing anything about the problem, but convincing the people that they're doing something so that things will go back to normal and that the police and everything, the criminal justice system, and everything in Chicago can continue working the way that it used to work, which included unleashing brutality and terror, targeting especially Black and Latino communities.
Mm-hmm. Now, Carl, we got about 10 minutes, right? So I wanted to actually 10, okay. Exactly. So, and there's a lot of questions I got. But one of the things that you referred to earlier, and you were talking about Avakian talking about the role of the police in society. And there's another piece that he wrote many years ago where he talked about the essence of dictatorship of all forms of state is a monopoly of armed force. And it's armed force that gets legitimated through the prevailing political system, the prevailing social compact, and the attendant ideological forms. And this is something that the very essence, the heart and the brain of the society rests on all this. It's their ability to have the monopoly of armed force legitimated no matter what they do. And as long as people believe in that, things are working like a well-oiled machine for the system. You know, not really, but that's what they would have. It's better than what they have now in a certain sense, because right now, this very essence of the society, the monopoly of armed force, actually how they stay in power, this is being challenged in a place like Chicago. I mean, this is incredible where you have these it's not stopping. It's not like I'm not saying, oh, well, you know, it's like it's going up and it's going over and it's all this other stuff. But there is actually a major assault on the legitimacy of the system's armed force, their rule of armed by armed force.
Yeah. And see, this is really critical because a key part of keeping any government in place is having the people that it rules over accepting the legitimacy of it utilizing armed force to keep the social order together. And the cops are a frontline part of that armed force. But if people begin to feel like the cops are wantonly brutalizing and murdering people, then that the legitimacy of that monopoly of armed force is getting pulled apart. And that is happening in Chicago. This is also why the protests around police murder have been such a problem for the authorities, and they've worked so hard to try to suppress them, because what people are challenging, even though they overwhelmingly don't realize it, is that they are challenging that monopoly on the use of legitimate force in society. If they're starting to say, we don't like the way your police operate in our communities, we don't like the way that they stop and frisk people targeting blacks and Latinos, we don't like the way that they arrest people seemingly on a whim, we don't like the way they brutalize people and even kill people, and your system always lets them get away with it. That's throwing up a challenge to the legitimacy of their monopoly on armed force. And in Chicago, that challenge is becoming more and more conscious. It's becoming more and more something that people are directly throwing out there with this call for everybody up to the mayor to be out of office, and then even calls for the mayor to be facing criminal prosecution, because it's public knowledge now that the mayor knew about the video of the murder of Laquan McDonald. He denies having seen it, but he acknowledges that he knew that it existed, which would be hard for him not to, because his legal arm, the legal arm of the city government, was defending the decision of the prosecutor, because by then it was the prosecutor's job to handle this, no longer just the police's job. It was the prosecutor's job to handle it, and the prosecutor's office was refusing to make it public. So you have all of these officials implicated in it, and it's at the level now where in Chicago they are discussing the crisis of legitimacy. Mainly it's being discussed by the talking heads in the media about how do we keep this together? How do we get the legitimacy back? What are the steps that we need to take to do that? Which is why the police chief got fired, somebody else stepped down. I forget who the other one was. But the mayor's drawing the line. He's not resigning, and he's going to preside over changing things. Then you have the Department of Justice saying that it's going to come in. All of this, though, really means nothing as far as stopping the problem, because these Department of Justice investigations, the Obama Justice Department has been in position about 7 years now. 7 years it's had the responsibility to police the police nationwide. Over that period, thousands upon thousands of people have been killed by police. More than 1,000 of them have been unarmed and doing nothing wrong when the police killed them. The Obama Justice Department, under first Eric Holder and then Loretta Lynch, has put zero cops on trial for having killed people. And these are all of these cops who have been exonerated by the local authorities. The Justice Department has investigated a few dozen times and decided to put on federal trial exactly zero cops in all of these killings.
Mm-hmm. Carl, I want to interject something here, because we have about 5 minutes right now.
Okay.
And I really want to make sure that we cover this last question. I know, and I appreciate it. And I think this is related. I just want to make sure that you're able to tie this in, because when you're talking about all this, it actually points to this thing about, look, we're talking about even though this is mainly centered right now in, when we're talking about this legitimacy crisis or developing legitimacy crisis in Chicago, this has repercussions nationwide, not least of the matter being that Rahm Emanuel is actually one of the Obama mob, you know, and you think about this, that whole thing is linked up. But then you look at the things that you're just that you're saying, these kinds of things that are going on. And there's a something I really want people to understand something, a legitimacy crisis. It's important to recognize that what's going on and understanding how you can act on it, what it means for the struggle for people to get a, to get out of this mess that we're in, and actually what it means for a revolution, because it's not a revolutionary crisis, but it certainly is a key ingredient of one. And I want you to talk about that, especially in relation to what's going on and the moment we're facing right now.
Yeah, actually, that's important in where this needs to go, because this is really centered in Chicago now, but it actually is something that is of national importance, and because of the role the U.S. plays in the world, international importance. It's nationally significant because the same kind of thing is going on all across the country without the breaking open of resistance and the role that it played in forcing the crisis coming up. And when people begin to question the legitimacy of the monopoly on legitimate armed force in the society, they are getting right at the foundations of that setup. Legitimacy crisis can come into being and can go out of being. Maybe these steps that they're taking will draw enough people back into accepting that the system can police itself and make things right. But the reality is that none of that's going to change that. It actually, it's going to take revolution, nothing less, to end this once and for all. We should live in a society where those entrusted with public security would sooner lose their own lives than kill or injure an innocent person. But it's going to take a revolution to bring that about. And this kind of revolution is possible because of the leadership and the work that Bob Avakian has been done, pointing to how you could make revolution and bring into being societies people would want to live in. And people who want to see an end to not only this horror of police terror, but all the other horrors the system brings down, the attacks on women, the attacks on immigrants, the destruction of the environment of the planet, they need to act on these horrors. And especially this one right here around police violence disproportionately targeting black people and other oppressed people, because this is a crucial Achilles heel of this system, a crucial vulnerability. And far from sitting back and seeing how it develops, we have to actually see that there's a role for us. We have to step up resistance on this front. We have to challenge the cover-ups and the injustice and the continued and intensifying brutality, terror, and murders that are being brought down by the police and being covered up and justified by the system, because acting on it can take a crisis of legitimacy and not only spread it and prolong it, but actually bring into being a revolutionary crisis, a crisis where the authorities can't continue to bamboozle people, oppress and exploit people in the old ways that they did, and where the people are no longer willing to be ruled over and governed in the old ways. And that creates an opening where a chance to make revolution and get rid of all of this mess actually can come into being. And those kinds of situations are rare, especially in countries like the U.S., and we can't sleep on it. In fact, we have to be acting now to go at this crisis of legitimacy, like I said, to spread it, but to be working to transform it into a crisis where the ability of the ruling class to continue to rule is being called into question and being gone at.
All right, Carl, on that note, we're going to have to wrap this up, man. But real quick, tell people how they can get in touch with you.
Okay. First off, go to the website revcom.us, where some of what we're talking about is being dealt with in articles about Chicago and other places around the country. Also, you should go to the Stop Mass Incarceration website, where there are going to be plans for moving forward off of Rise Up October. And you can hit me on Twitter at Carl_Dix, older school via email, carldix@hotmail.com.
All right, Carl Dix, thank you very much for joining us today, and look forward to talking to you again real soon, man.
Okay, thank you for having me on again.
All right, take care. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Carl Dixon, a Revolutionary Communist Party, the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
Running down a dark street, act that got a flashlight, Nike swoosh on bare feet, Whitney Houston's crack pipe. The greatest love of all, watch me rise to watch me fall, contemplating rent is laid and ounces that I can't afford. Show my papers at Heaven's gates, they ask me for my fee. Lived a life without no hate, so tell me what you need to question your authority, genocide and poverty.
All right, welcome back. That was Saul Williams with Burundi. All right, right now we're going to listen to a piece from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and it's a piece called Yes, There's a Conspiracy to Get the Cops Off. So here's Bob Avakian.
Think about what happened to Amadou Diallo in New York. Now, Richard Pryor used to have this routine he did to show what it was like for a black man just in an ordinary encounter with the police. How you had to try to avoid being one of those mistakes where you got killed. He'd talk about a black man gets pulled over by the police and he has to say, I am reaching into my pocket for my license because I don't want to be no motherfucking accident. You have to show them and make clear and loud that you're going into your pocket to bring out your wallet. Otherwise, they'll say you had a gun and shoot you down. And for Amadou Diallo, even that didn't work. Amadou Diallo pulled out his wallet and held it up, and they shot him down anyway. 41 times they shot at him. They pumped his body with bullets. Or look what happened around here to Taisha Miller. The police came up on her. She was in a car, apparently passed out. Her family came up, they begged the police because the car was locked, let them find a way to open it. But no, the police couldn't wait. They fired into the car 29 times, shooting her in the back 12 times. And that wasn't the worst of it. When the family came and was grieving, the cops started mocking them with racist taunts. Oh, what is this, Kwanzaa? What is this, the Watts whale? This is America. This is the greatest of all countries. Well, what about what happened with Donovan Jackson and how the cops got off on that thing, too? They took him, they punched him in the face and slammed his head down on a car for no good reason and no reason at all. But they got off. One of them got acquitted completely and the other one, oh, you know, the jury couldn't decide. But let's not blame the jury as much as the judge and the prosecutor. Whenever they're forced to put a cop on trial for brutality or murder, all of a sudden the prosecutors forget how to prosecute. Anybody who has a case, I'm sure they say, God damn, give me that prosecutor when I got my case go up. They don't call witnesses. They don't ask the witnesses the right questions. They accept the defense theory of what happened and then argue little nitpicky things about it within that framework. The same thing happened with the Amadou Diallo case. The jury found him not guilty, and one of the jurors afterwards said, I wish we could have found him guilty. I hope they sue him, those cops, and get all kinds of money out of him. But the way the judge set it up, we had to go by the law, so we couldn't find him guilty. Well, they should have found him guilty anyway, but you know what she's saying. And the judge is part of it, too. It's part of the conspiracy. Yes, there's a conspiracy to get the cops off. What happened in the Rampart scandal, a scandal in L.A.? They shot up this dude, Latino brother. Then they accused him of assaulting the police. He comes into court in a wheelchair. He's convicted. The judge gives him almost a maximum sentence. Why? Because he didn't show remorse. For what? He didn't do any goddamn thing. But this is the way it works. And what happened when they finally had to put these Rampart cops, or a couple of them, on trial? The judge did everything she could to get the jury not to find him guilty. But this time, the jury found him guilty anyway, so the judge threw out the verdict. Yes, there's a conspiracy to get the cops off.
All right, once again, that was Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and it was a piece taken from his speech, Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. And you can access the entire speech at revolutiontalk.net. We're going to take a short break and be right back with Stephanie Myers, one of the co-editors of The Atheist Guide to Christmas, and writer, satirist Paul Krasner, one of the contributors to the book. So stay tuned, you definitely don't want to miss this one.
Well, I walked to town in the pouring rain, paid my fare and I rode that train to the station under the avenue, hit the air at the stroke of noon. At the cross streets where I staked my claim, I played in tune with the winter rain, collecting dimes and dollar bills while the noisy traffic played the fills, and it's Christmas time in the city.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Michael Slate Show, and that was Mary Chapin Carpenter with Christmas Time in the City, a really beautiful song. And imagine this, it manages to capture the spirit of the season, and best of all, takes the holy out of holiday. In that spirit, I'm really happy to welcome our next guest to the show. Stephanie Myers is one of the editors of what I found to be one of the more fascinating books of the Christmas season, The Atheist Guide to Christmas. And Paul Krasner is one of the contributors of this, as well as being, and Paul's got a, he has got a, I don't know, I'd say he's got a bio that stretches about a football field long. And he's always been one of the people who I've looked to in the world to kind of look at and understand that there's really, both through satire and through telling the truth, he's really helped a lot of people see what reality is. He's the author of Confessions of a Raving Unconfined Nut, Misadventures in the Counterculture, and he's the recent recipient of a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Oakland branch of Penn. So, Stephanie, Paul, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Sure. Well, Stephanie, let's jump into it with you first. What the hell got into you to get into this Atheist Guide to Christmas, hmm?
Well, you know, it actually started a couple years ago with the UK Atheist Bus Campaign, where UK journalist Ariane Shireen noticed that a lot of Christian organizations were advertising on buses, and she said, you know what, why can't we do that? So she set out to raise a little bit of money and ended up raising £150,000 to do bus advertisements saying, there's probably no God, now stop worrying and enjoy your life. So at that point, it just seemed like there was the energy and the excitement to turn something like that into a book with that same sort of attitude. So that's where this came from.
Mm-hmm. And how did you get involved in it?
You know, I am closely in touch with HarperCollins UK colleagues, and so they sent over this project. And being someone who was never raised practicing a religion but who loves Christmas as well as other holidays, I mean, I'm just as excited about Halloween as Christmas, honestly. But it spoke to me, and there were such great contributors signed up and so many different types of essays and so many different ways that people still really enjoyed the holidays despite their religious affiliations or non-affiliations. So I just thought it was such a fun project.
And Paul, how about you? How did you get involved in this?
Stephanie invited me to contribute, and it was for a good cause. Stephanie can talk more about that. And it was an opportunity to see that this is another little evolutionary jump in atheism coming out of the closet. You know, I mean, when I was a kid, I got beaten up for it. It's a sign of progress in that, so I was happy to accept her invitation.
Now, you grew up in New York?
Yes.
Okay, and are you telling me that you expect me to believe that there were gangs of God-filled heathens or God-filled whatever, hooligans? Not heathens, God-filled hooligans who were beating up heathens?
Well, no. It wasn't a gang. You know, it was just like one or two guys from junior high school.
Ah, okay. Well, I got beat up by a gang of nuns, you know. That was. I also got
really?
Strangled. Yes, I got strangled by the bishop, too, when I got my confirmation because I asked the question you weren't supposed to ask. Wait a minute. How can you be three gods in one? The bishop actually slapped my face really hard, knocked me off the altar rail, and that sort of marked my exit from Catholicism. So,
Huh.
Yeah.
Oh, so, yeah, no, but that's a very nice visual picture, a gang of nuns.
It may be nice to talk about now, but I still have horrible, horrible nightmares about it.
Uh-huh. Well, that's interesting. I mean, as an atheist, I don't have a believe in a God to get mad at me. But it is a paradox, Michael, because not only am I an atheist, but I'm also an absurdist. And what could be more absurd than for an atheist to have continuing dialogue with the deity he doesn't believe exists?
And are you saying that you do that?
Oh, sure. You know, like as a stand-up satirist, when I'm in the green room waiting to go on, I'll say, please, God, help me do a good show. And then I'll hear the voice of God say, shut up, you superstitious fool.
Okay, there's so much to unravel about that, Paul. I don't know where to begin.
We're talking with writer and satirist Paul Krasner, one of the contributors to The Atheist Guide to Christmas, and Stephanie Myers, a co-editor of the book.
Stephanie, Paul mentioned the idea that atheists actually, and who knows whether this is absolutely true, but atheists, and I know from my own experience and having been an atheist for a very long time, but also talking with other people around it, and I've talked with P.Z. Myers about this, there's a tendency, not only are atheists, like in this country in particular, really cowled, or there's that idea that they're the most hated minority in the country, but there's really, people are not very aggressive and assertive when it comes to their atheist beliefs. And in Britain and in Europe, it's a little bit of a different story, but you've gotten a number of people from the U.S. to actually contribute to this atheist guide. How did you find doing that? How did you find the people to do that?
You know, it's funny. I was responsible for bringing in more U.S. contributors. And, of course, I had my list of big names. And then I wanted to find more up-and-coming writers. And I was literally just Googling, you know, lists of up-and-coming atheists or, you know, lists of feminist atheists and just trying to find great people who are talking. Like one person, Jennifer McCrate, who blogs at blaghag.com. She's a young grad student. And I think she's just brilliant and someone to keep an eye on, so I was really excited about finding that. But I would say I'm someone who's totally guilty of being an in-the-closet atheist, and until I worked on this project, I just hadn't thought about it. It was something that didn't come up in life ever, and so working on this, I've really started to see that there's some point to talking a little bit more about it, and it's been an interesting evolution for me, and I'm excited to bring that to other people, because really it's such a tame-looking book, right? It's a great entryway. If someone isn't feeling aggressive about it and really doesn't want to commit to a longer, more in-depth book, this is a great thing to start off and get a sense of who's writing in this space.
Well, you know, it's interesting because it's sort of, yes, the book is, you know, it's got snowflakes on the front. It says The Atheist Guide to Christmas, and you put featuring Richard Dawkins and a number of other people. And then when you open it up, it actually is a lot different than what I expected to find, actually. I mean, I really enjoyed all of the various stories. Now, I'd ask you, leaving aside Paul for a moment, what is one of your favorite stories in here?
I really love Simon Singh's piece, which is about celebrating a different birth, which is the birth of the universe at Christmas. And I think it's a great mixture of good writing and good science. And that's really one of my favorites.
Now, Paul, in your piece, you actually, I mean, it's very interesting because you don't just talk about yourself developing as an atheist, although I found that really fascinating and funny, but I also felt you also did something that was very horrifying, which is, and revealing, when you talked about the title of your piece is There's No Atheists in the White House. Can you talk about some of the things that you revealed in that, which I thought are mind-blowing, because people don't know this stuff about the presidents and their conversations with this non-existent deity?
Yes, well, I did some research because there was so much religious piety coming out of the White House, and my attitude towards believers is not hostile, because whether they use it as a crutch or they believe it sincerely, my turning point was when, because I was more militant then than I am now, but what was my turning point was that Martin Luther King was a Christian, and he was a kind, moral activist, humane. Whereas at the same time, George Lincoln Rockwell, who was the head of the American Nazi Party, called himself an agnostic. So the tipping point for me was to start just relating to people not by what they believed, but how they related to humans and animals and the earth. And so I don't categorize that. And so in my research, but I did believe that people who thought that God actually talked to them were deluded, including George Bush. And then in my research, I found out that his father said the same kind of things, an atheist shouldn't be in the White House, that went back to Lyndon Johnson. You know, it was, and there were others. And there's only one, Abby Hoffman once told me, Abby Hoffman, the late activist and co-founder of the Yippies, started out as another co-founder, Jerry Rubin did, working within the system. And Abby was supporting some candidate in Boston. And somebody asked the candidate about religion, and he said, oh, I'm an atheist. And the reporters started walking out. They said, okay, there goes the ball game. And so currently now, I think Pete Stark is the only, I guess, as you say, openly gay, openly atheistic in the entire legislature. So, and there were laws in some states. In the article, I mentioned specifically in different states where they said that nobody could be a candidate if they didn't profess a belief in God. So it shows the background of the kind of thing that religion and politics are in the same bed together. And you know, and they always had Billy Graham come there. And even when Richard Nixon, one of the tapes revealed, was saying some of his anti-Semitic remark, Billy Graham agreed. You know, and that's as bad as saying itself. I wrote to the Anti-Defamation League about that and never heard back.
Yeah, well, it's interesting how much comes out of the mouths of these God-fearing people. I mean, it's even, you know, you have General Boykin, and you have all the thing that happened in Fallujah, where people were, these commanders in Iraq were demand, you know, as they're committing this horrific slaughter and one of the worst war crimes in the Iraq War in Fallujah, and they're talking about that the face of Satan is in there, and they're going to go in and defeat Satan for God, you know. And it's, I mean, this kind of thing that develops here, it's interesting to me because you have the most, and even with Bush, when you were talking about Bush's father in your article, you actually make the point that George Bush the First actually made the point not just that people shouldn't occupy the White House, but he doesn't know that atheists should be considered citizens.
Well, you know, there was one thing, you mentioned that I got the Penn Lifetime Achievement Award. And so in my speech, I always knew, I made a vow to myself that if I ever got an award like that, this is what I would do. And so I said, you know, you don't get a Lifetime Achievement Award for just doing everything alone. You know, you collaborated with people, you were supported by people and nurtured. And I said, and I would like to thank these people in chronological order, starting with my parents, and who were embarrassed by what I wrote and even ashamed of it, but nevertheless, you know, I was editing The Realist, which was considered by others as the hippest magazine in America, but I was still living with my parents. Okay, so I said, but first and foremost, I don't know about, many of you don't know too much about my spiritual quest, and so first of all, I would like to thank Satan. And I... And the people who knew me there, you know, laughed. But there were, you know, various book awards, and the people who came for that, they were silent because there was no way to tell that that I wasn't being sincere. And I mean, in fact, I have said to people, you know, when they read it in the San Francisco Chronicle and knew about it, and they asked me about it, and I said, well, you know, it was a tough competition, but I beat out Justin Bieber. And a lot of people said, oh, yeah, yes, and he's only 14. I said, yes, but he's writing his memoir.
Okay, all right, that's a good one there. We're talking with Stephanie Myers, one of the co-editors of The Atheist Guide to Christmas, and to writer and satirist Paul Krassner, one of the contributors to this anthology. Paul, just one more quick question for you at the moment is, you know, people, Stephanie talked about her own sort of being reticent about coming out with her atheism. You actually became an atheist in a way. Becoming an atheist actually introduced you to a whole other world of, it seemed, in what you described in the article. It really was a sort of a process that brought you into a whole other social world that really seemed to have an effect on shaping the rest of your life.
That's true. You know, it was a religious experience. That's the irony of it. I had been... Because you can see, trace the chain of events that led you to it. But I started out in college in a philosophy course. I had to do a paper, and I wanted to do one on a dialogue between Plato and an atheist. And just on a whim, I looked up atheism in the telephone book, and there it was. You know, they put the word that you're looking up left. So it was Atheist American Association of, 4 A's. And I found that I went to a little office there, and they were met the editor of their paper, The Truth Seeker, which later became an anti-Semitic hate rag, but, you know, because it, when he died, they got a different editor. But they had an ism forum, which was to talk about all the different isms at a little dinky, the Algonquin Hotel, you might remember that.
Yeah.
It was very funky, and it was in a big ballroom with chairs all around the perimeter. And then one little stage there. And so I went to that and met people there, and they went to a restaurant for a thing, and then they told me about the Rationalist Society, so I went to another meeting, and there was the MC for that evening was a former circus performer who could hold 4 golf balls in his mouth and demonstrated it. You know, I said, so this is atheism. And so, and he mentioned a paper called The Independent, And I went and got to the office of the Independent and met Lyle Stewart, who was the biggest influence of my life. He, too, was an atheist, and he edited a paper that was the forerunner of the alternative press. And I started out stuffing envelopes there and became the managing editor. And out of that developed The Realist, which was essentially the banner logo on the front was a free thought criticism and satire. So it started out with that, and the first subscriber was Steve Allen, who bought several subscriptions for others, and then one of whom was Lenny Bruce, and Lenny sent out subscriptions to a lot of people. So it grew in a Malthusian way, and Lenny became the other big influence in my life as a satirist, and I ended up editing his autobiography. So in answer to your question, that there was this chain of events that I label as random destiny.
All right. You know, and I have to tell you, Paul, when I was a kid, I was reading The Realist because there was only one kid in my neighborhood, Lenny Dicardi, and his parents they gave him permission to actually get that all the time, and he would share it with me, and we used to sit in his basement and read that, and it was incredible, including there were some that just you'd left you sitting there with your mouth open. You know, it was so mind-blowing just to read it. So I wanted to thank you for that. Yeah, it's really...
No, you know, you just painted a beautiful picture. I can picture it, almost like a Norman Rockwell.
Yeah, exactly.
But through the basement window, you can see a gang of nuns rushing at you.
Right. You got it, exactly. Oh, you had to bring those nuns up again. Now, Stephanie, one more question for you. You had, and I have to say, when you mentioned Jennifer McCrate, her gift for the godless is priceless, and I won't say anything more about it, but people really have to check this out. And I would say something I want to read before we go, but I want to ask you one question, one of my favorite essays in here is the one by Brian Cox, which I think is very similar to what you were talking about, but I just found there's a whole part of the end that really I think is really good. I wanted to ask you this. The idea that you brought together such a wide array of people from Paul, who actually, I mean, as we're talking about, it's very humorous. There's a lot of satire involved in his, and there's a lot of truth telling. You also bring physicists. You bring scientists into it. You bring political forces into it. You bring comedians into it. You know, how did you, that kind of vision, what kind of response have you gotten to it? How did you actually bring these people together or develop that kind of vision to have that breadth of view? And then what's the response been?
You know, I have to give a lot of credit to Robin, who is my co-editor, who did a lot, almost more of the legwork than I did. But really, once people found out about it, a lot of people wanted to be involved. And word sort of spread through the atheist/skeptic community, and we were contacted by people who wanted to volunteer as well. So it actually was maybe much easier than it looked, because so many people from so many different areas of expertise, once they heard about it, really wanted to join in. Mm-hmm.
Okay, Paul, Stephanie, I want to thank you both very much for joining us today.
Oh, it was delightful. Anytime.
And we'll have you back. Okay, take care now. Great. And happy holidays.
Oh, one thing, Michael. God bless you.
Okay, you did it again. There are those nuns charging through the door. Thanks, Paul. See you later now. Talk to you later.
All right, well, we've run out of time, so we got to be real quick. I want to thank everybody who was involved in the production of this and everybody who's listening. And if you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com.
The silvery sound of sleigh bells, the rap of reindeer hooves, a man all clothed in crimson, he runs from roof to roof. He clambers down the chimneys, leaves toys neath all the trees, till anyone home, the lights click on, and someone yells out, freeze, Santa's doing time.